Hello, this is Tom Switzer. Welcome to Between the Lines.
And we learned that he has no desire and no capacity to lead the world. He was an uneasy, lonely, awkward figure at this gathering, and you got the strong sense that some of the leaders are trying to find the best way to work around him. Donald Trump has pressed fast forward on the decline of the United States as a global leader. He managed to isolate his nation, to confuse and alienate his allies, and to diminish America. Some will cheer the decline of America, but I think we'll miss it when it's gone. And that's the biggest threat to the values of the West, which he claims to hold so dear.
Well, that was the ABC's Chris Uhlmann on President Trump at the G20 summit in Hamburg last month. Now, remember that video clip? It went viral all over the globe, didn't it? So, was Chris Uhlmann's analysis sound? Is that uneasy, lonely, awkward president damaging American credibility and prestige, and as a result, diminishing the American global leadership role that has been part and parcel of international relations for decades? What will replace the Pax Americana? Will the US take its diminished status gracefully? Or will it lash out, as most declining great powers are historically prone to do? Well, these are important questions for Australia. After all, our leaders have invested so much capital in our alliance with the Americans. So in coming weeks, we'll deal with these issues with both Americans and Australians. So let's get started. And who better to get the ball rolling than today's guest? Mary Kissel is a member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. Before that, she was the editor of the Wall Street Journal Asia in Hong Kong. She's in the country this week as a guest of the Institute of Public Affairs in Melbourne. G'day, Mary. Welcome back to Between the Lines.
Oh, great to be with you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Now, you heard Chris Uhlmann. Is America, under Donald Trump's leadership, really in serious decline?
Well, let's just start with the foreign policy front, Tom, given your introduction. I actually think that Chris Uhlmann has it exactly backward. The big question about Donald Trump is whether or not he would re-engage America in the world after we had 8 years of retreat. Recall that President Obama pulled troops out of Iraq. He pulled down our presence in Afghanistan. He did a deal with our enemies in Iran and in Cuba, empowering rogue powers. He did absolutely nothing when Russia invaded Crimea, eastern Ukraine. And he also didn't enforce the red line in Syria, allowing Russia and Iran to prop up the murderer, Bashar al-Assad. And so what did President Trump do? The first thing he did is he sent troops and missiles back into Poland and eastern Europe. He has started to reestablish U.S. deterrence by bombing Syria when they used chemical weapons, breaking that red line that Obama set. He's doing freedom of navigation operations around China's islands in the South China Sea that are there illegally. And when North Korea launched intercontinental ballistic missiles, Donald Trump sent bombers over the Korean Peninsula, and he tested our anti-missile systems. So if anything, I think this is a signal that America is re-engaging in the world, that we are trying to salvage what is left of American deterrence after the Obama years. And I'm not saying it's all going to come out roses, Tom, but I think that it is very, very important to see a renewed American power in the Asia-Pacific region, not just rhetorically, but also by shows of force. And that's what you're seeing.
What about those polls we keep hearing about? In June, we had the Pew Research Center put out a survey. It was 37 countries, and it found that a medium of just 22% had confidence in Trump to do the right thing in foreign policy. Now, that compared to 64% during the final years of the Obama era.
Yeah.
Now, and I'd also add, and this is what really threw me, Mary, a striking 47% expressed a positive view of communist China. The US was just 2 percentage points higher at 49%. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think two ways, Tom. I think part of that has to do with the propagandizing of the media about China. I'm recalling, for instance, that famous Tom Friedman column at the New York Times several years back where he said he wished that America could be more like China. You know, forget the rampant corruption, the human rights violations, you know, the disappearances. It's just ridiculous. So some part of that opinion poll has to do with the bad information, I think, that many get, especially here in Australia, too. Part of it has to do with the education system, that students today just aren't taught about the horrors of communism and socialism and where it all leads. It's ridiculous to think that President Obama left the world safer than he got it. Mm-hmm. That is patently untrue. You look at the spread and the geographic reach of just terrorism, just to name one thing, and you see ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram and other of these groups in a far broader geographic reach than it was when he took office, not to mention the rise of Iran, China, Russia, North Korea. So, you know, Trump has inherited a very, very dangerous world here.
Yeah, no question about that. And it's true that, you know, Obama did leave a more divided, polarizing and uncertain nation. But couldn't you argue that Obama also inherited a pretty divided, polarizing and uncertain nation from George W. Bush?
Well, I mean, are we
overlooking the Iraq invasion, the global financial crisis?
Well, hang on, Tom. The invasion suggests that the United States went into Iraq to conquer and plunder, which is absolutely not what happened, nor was it the goal of the intervention there. Barack Obama inherited a stable, democratic Iraq. Vice President Joe Biden went on the Charlie Rose show and boasted about it in the first year of the Obama presidency. He said this would be one of the Obama administration's great achievements. We've argued at the Wall Street Journal editorial page, all it would have taken is to leave a couple thousand troops in Iraq, and they could have taken out ISIS immediately. You wouldn't have had this virulent spread of terrorism across the Levant, even if we had just a nominal presence left in Iraq. For God's sakes, we've had tens of thousands of troops in South Korea since the Korean War. And no one in America is upset about that. That was a lack of real political courage and political will. I think a lot of naivete on the part of Obama. But look, those years are over. Donald Trump is now the president of the United States. He owns the foreign policy of the United States. And I have to say, it's a very dangerous spot that we're in. But I'm glad that he's at least leveling with the American people about the nature of the threat. I think he has great advisors in James Mattis and McMaster. I don't know about Tillerson. And I think, you know, not a lot of choices in places like North Korea, but at least he's addressing them.
Yeah. I mean, Trump clearly resonated with a significant segment of war-weary Americans on the campaign last year, in some respects like Bernie Sanders. Whenever Trump would, you know, rail against the American penchant for promoting democracy, subsidizing allies' defenses, the military interventions in the Middle East that he railed against, all the things that a Bush and Obama have supported, Bush in Iraq, Obama in Libya, he resonated with a war-weary people. So couldn't you argue that Trump instinctively is very much against that global leadership role that you admire about America?
Well, what did he say? He said America first. And many people in the media suggested that that was a reference to Charles Lindbergh's America Firstism back in the 30s. Mm. I think that's absurd. Do you really think that Donald Trump was aware of Charles Lindbergh and his outlook on the world in the 30s? I doubt it. I think it was a much more simple approach to say we're going to put American interests first and we're going to protect Americans here at home and we're going to protect our interests abroad. And if at all possible, we don't want to deploy U.S. troops. We'd love to empower our allies to do that for us on our behalf, but also on their behalf, of course. And you've seen that in practice. Trump has effectively forced our NATO allies to finally step up to the plate and start paying for their own defense, which I think a lot of Americans are relieved to see. I don't think a Jeb Bush or a Marco Rubio as president could have achieved that. You've seen him rally the Sunni nations.
When Trump came to power, 24 out of 28 NATO allies were paying less than the 2% of the GDP. How many of them now are paying 2% of their GDP on defense?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, Tom, but I do think that there have been commitments from several of them to exceed that. Poland and the Baltic nations, of course, have always, and Greece, because of the Cypriot conflict, have always paid that amount. But it was, prior to Trump, a tiny fraction. You know, the other thing that he's done is to rally the Sunni nations together and start reestablishing links with places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and others to get them to help us fight ISIS in the Middle East. That's very positive. And he's formed a very close relationship with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, whom he welcomed to New York prior to taking the oath of office. And then he subsequently welcomed again to his home in beautiful Palm Beach County, Florida, where I'm from. And they had a wonderful meeting there. Warren, he met Abe before he met Xi Jinping. That sent a message.
Well, let's get your reaction to something that John Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago, this is what he told me recently on Sunday Extra.
There's a huge clash going on in the United States between Trump, who is attacking the liberal international order that the American elites love. So you have this big fight taking place between the foreign policy establishment on one hand and Trump on the other hand. And the question is, who's going to win? But in the meantime, it produces an American foreign policy that is really discombobulated and hard to make sense of. And this drives allies in places like East Asia crazy, which is of great consequence if you believe, like I do, that it's important to contain China. If the United States is going to contain China, it needs a president who's thinking strategically and is working closely with the South Koreans, the Japanese, the Australians, the Filipinos, and so forth and so on, to cobble together a smart strategy of containment. But that's not what we have, because Trump is basically a loose cannon. And what he's doing is unnerving our allies in East Asia, which is not a smart way to deal with a rising China, in my opinion.
John Mearsheimer here on RN a few weeks ago. Now, the clash between Trump and America's foreign policy elites, it has been a big issue in the media, at least over the last 6 to 18 months. Mary, does that perplex and even frighten U.S. allies, as John Mearsheimer suggests?
Well, I'm confused about his comments, because when you speak of the American foreign policy elites, that's the Council on Foreign Relations set in New York. Let's be clear about what they support. They supported the deal that President Obama did with Iran that paid a state sponsor of terrorism $100 billion and did nothing about their sponsor of terrorism, of Hezbollah, of the Houthis, of support of ISIS in Syria. They did nothing when China engaged in a lot of adventurism in the South China Sea and built those artificial islands that are illegal. So what they would like to see, I think, is the continuation of American retreat from the world. And Tom, what I've just described to you is the opposite of that.
Yeah.
Now, there is one thing I do want to say here. And Mearsheimer says that there's a lack of a strategic policy in Asia Pacific. I agree with him on that. Trump is a transactional president. He deals with the threats in front of him. So there is a concern that he's focused on the North Korean crisis, the fact that you've got a crazy guy, well, not so crazy, actually, a smart guy, who has an intercontinental ballistic missile now capable of hitting the United States. He's dealing with that crisis. But is there thinking going on in the broader administration about the larger Asia policy? I have my concerns about that.
Yeah, I think Mearsheimer meant when he talked about the foreign policy elites in both parties, you know, the liberal interventionists in the Democratic Party, the neoconservatives, the more hawkish elements in the Republican Party. And although they express themselves in different ways, they subscribe to this notion that America should be the global leader, a benign global hegemon, the indispensable nation, as Madeleine Albright. And Mearsheimer's point is those policies, especially since 9/11, have been a disaster. Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib, all that. That's what he means when he's talking about Trump railing against that. And in many respects, Mary, you could argue that many of those folks in those Rust Belt states who are war-weary, who are sick and tired of seeing their country lose blood and treasure and needless wars, that message resonated with those folks. To the extent that is true, that contradicts the elite view, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't know about that, Tom. A large part of the election of Donald Trump wasn't just the dissatisfaction with the economic malaise, which the weakest recovery since the 1930s. It was also a very well-founded fear of terrorism. We've had killings, slaughters in Orlando, San Bernardino, Boston. Mm. We had bombs going off in the middle of Chelsea in New York. And we had a president telling us, you're more likely to die from a fall in a bathtub than you are in a terror attack. I mean, that's absurd. Your bathtub isn't trying to set off a dirty bomb. So, you know, a large part of the appeal of Trump was, we're going to reassert America's influence. I'm going to protect you. I'm not going to ignore threats in the world. We're going to talk about what's going on in North Korea. We're going to talk about how China props up North Korea. We're going to be honest about that. We're going to level with the American people, and we're going to deal with it. You know, I far prefer that to the limp response that we saw out of the last administration that said, you know what, there's nothing America can do. We're just in an inexorable decline. We have to accept that China's going to dominate Asia. We have to accept that we're going to have a revolutionary jihadist regime in Tehran that's going to influence and control and affect a vast swath of the Levant. That is not the attitude of this White House. And frankly, as an American, I think that's terrific. And I think many Americans would agree with me.
If just tuned in, you're with me, Tom Switzer from RN. I'm chatting with the Wall Street Journal's Mary Kissel about America and the world. She's a guest here of the IPA this week. Mary, how does Trump solve a problem like North Korea?
Well, Trump has very limited options thanks to the very poor decision-making in the George W. Bush administration, a Republican administration, and the Barack Obama administration, a Democratic administration. Both of those presidents engaged in talking. Obama finally adopted a policy of what's called strategic patience, which was effectively to do nothing. And that allowed North Korea to cooperate with regimes like Iran to develop a nuclear weapons program and an intercontinental ballistic missile program.
What about the Bush policy? What was the Bush policy?
Well, the Bush policy was to sit down and talk, the six-party talks.
But what's the alternative?
Well, he has a couple of alternatives. The first is to really ramp up pressure on China and make it so painful for China to support North Korea that they finally do pull the plug on the Kim regime in terms of the energy, the trade, and all the rest of it, and they help us change that regime in Pyongyang. Now, I don't think that Trump has taken measures like that yet. Yes, he has imposed some sanctions, but they haven't been painful enough to, for instance, cut the Bank of China off from U.S. financing, the SWIFT system, the so-called SWIFT system. He hasn't done that yet. We could start positioning assets off the Korean Peninsula. We have made it clear that there will be consequences if he threatens us.
Do we seek the downfall of this regime?
Absolutely we do.
But how would China respond? Because from China's national interest perspective, they would see this as a serious threat because it would unleash a refugee crisis and increase the prospects of a reunified Korea being under a U.S. security umbrella.
Well, you say China would see that as a threat, Tom, and that is an implicit assumption that there's one view in China about North Korea, and we know that that's not the case. Yeah. We know that there's been increasing concern in Beijing about a regime that may provoke or have to provoke America to react. China doesn't want that either. China doesn't want a nuclear Japan, which is something that may happen in very short order if we see this conflict escalate. So China also has reason here not to see the Kim regime provoke the United States. Now, frankly, I think that China will not help us. I think some in the regime in Beijing think that it's good to have this buffer state, no matter how nuts they are. But again, that just makes it that much more important for the United States to start to increase the pain on Beijing, which I think they will end up doing.
Let's turn to Washington. Now, presidents, as you well know, thrive ideally when they're both loved and feared politically. Is Trump either?
No, he's not. He's not loved. He may call them fake polls, but man, every single poll that's coming out is showing that this guy has really terrible approval ratings.
Although he's loved by his base, and that's important for him.
Yeah, he's loved by his base, but he also has to get some legislative accomplishments there to satisfy the base.
Well, that's interesting because the Republican Party, his own center-right conservative party, they control Congress, yet Trump is struggling to pass any legislation. Why is that the case?
Yeah, and recall that we were told that Trump is going to be a fascist and a dictator.
Yeah, that's
right. Take away our freedoms. What happened to that?
Well, this is the checks and balances in the U.S. system, isn't it?
Well, it shows you how terrible the media coverage is and how wrong they were. Mm-hmm. Trump has respected checks and balances.
And that argument that he was some kind of fascist was peddled by not just left wingers, but neoconservatives like Robert Kagan.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it absolutely was. If anything, on the domestic front, he's proved a weak president. He can't get his immigration law through the courts. He can't corral Republicans in Congress to pass his agenda. It's very frustrating for
him. Well, but then, it's not fascism, obviously, but there is some measure of chaos. Now, there have been some changes, but what are people looking forward to? I mean, your colleague, Jason Riley from the Wall Street Journal recently said that Trump has a divided country. He has a divided Republican caucus, a divided White House. And Riley went on to say you can't get anything done with all those divisions. And I suppose you also give Democrats all the fodder they need to be obstructionists, right?
Well, look, the things that made Trump successful as a candidate, his strength, his decisiveness, his declarations of what he was going to do, do not work to his advantage as president, because presidents have to persuade the American public and they have to persuade their members in Congress of their agenda. And what we saw in the healthcare debate was Trump simply refused or was unable, or perhaps both, to explain why his healthcare reform was ultimately going to help the poorest Americans and the folks that really need healthcare. And as a result, the approval ratings of this bill were very low because the Democrats explained it from their perspective, and they essentially won the argument, and Republicans caved. And so we'll see if Trump can persuade the American people in Congress about tax reform. It's a subject he knows a lot better, but now he's really under the gun. He doesn't have many weeks to pass it.
Mary, you mentioned Trump's and the media's contempt for him. I mean, is there a danger that we in the media, the intellectual world, that we are using a different scorecard here? I mean, are the Trump supporters in the middle of the country looking at different things? They like the shakeup, that it isn't Hillary Clinton. They love the fact that a conservative like Neil Gorsuch is on the Supreme Court. They love the executive orders that take the regulations off. I mean, these aren't traditional legislative wins, but they do resonate with a lot of people who are sick and tired of Washington as it has been over the last few decades, correct?
Well, it's not just sick and tired of Washington, Tom. You have to underscore the economic distress, the damage that has been carried on our nation for the past 8 years. 2% growth, no real rise in wages, 1 in 7 Americans on food stamps, rising health care costs, uncertainty in the small business community about their health care and their tax burdens. This has been a disastrous decade for America, and people are desperate. They need change. They need lower taxes, smaller government. They want the regulators off their back, and they want to be safe, Tom.
Yeah.
I mean, if these terror attacks can happen at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, well, heck, where else can it happen?
Yeah.
Is it going to happen in Minnesota? Is it going to happen in, you know,
and on the domestic front,
Charleston?
We should say that contrary to the conventional wisdom after the election, the stock market has gone gangbusters. I think it just it's grown 20% since Trump's election. It's gone past 22,000.
You know,
right?
Look, Milton Friedman always used to say you have to separate the stock market from the real economy. They're not the same things. And I think Trump really risks a lot by taking credit for the stock market as it goes up. But you know what? That means that he's going to have to own it if it goes down. And if he doesn't pass tax reform, I think you're going to see a reevaluation of the economic health of America on the markets.
Now, you've been in Australia this week. You covered our politics when you were editor of the Asian Wall Street Journal during the Howard Rudd Gillard years. Now, from afar in New York, Mary, what's your sense of Australian politics in the Turnbull era?
I think the Turnbull era is effectively a centrist Labor government. I think that the conservative movement is adrift in this country and divided, just like it is in Britain, just like it is in the United States. I think it's a crisis of conservatism. And, you know, you talk to Turnbull supporters and he'll say, you know, he doesn't have a big majority, and that's true. However, if he had a clear set of principles, I think that you would see him attempt much, much more on the agenda. The energy crisis, Tom, you know, as an outsider looking in, is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. This country is so rich in resources. The idea that government has mucked up the market so much, regulated so much, and with such a heavy hand that Australians have to pay double-digit increases in their energy costs just shows you how much damage bad governance can do. And I'm afraid Turnbull has a lot to do with
that.
Well,
you covered in great detail the period in late 2009 when Turnbull was the opposition leader and he tried to meet to Kevin Rudd's emissions trading scheme. Do you see a sense here where Kevin Rudd is also joining forces with the Labor Party to pass carbon climate mitigation in disguise?
Well, as I said, I view Turnbull as a Labor prime minister.
Yeah.
And, you know, his renewable energy targets have absolutely crippled South Australia. Let's remember, what are renewable energy targets? Because this is never explained. It's government saying we prefer this sort of energy to what the market would naturally choose. And when you've got a couple of bureaucrats choosing what kind of energy you're going to have versus millions of people in a market, you're always going to get a bad decision. And so effectively, they are inflicting pain on the poorest Australians, who are the ones that have to pay the most out of their budget for energy. I think it's absolutely disgraceful. And the idea that they've brought in a huckster like Elon Musk to feed off the backs of Australian taxpayers in the same way that he did American taxpayers just tells you that these folks are naive or just really ideological, and they just don't care about the burden on the average
Paul
Australian.
Kelly, whom you know, the distinguished Australian journalist, he has said that the center of political gravity has shifted to the interventionist left, with both sides of politics now embracing increasing the size and the scope of the government. I mean, how do you think conservatives and liberals generally should better sell the ideas of productivity-enhancing economic reform that can kickstart a new era of reform?
I think most Australians instinctively understand in the value of work, in the value of risk-taking, in the value of entrepreneurship. They don't understand when government comes in and says, you know, we want to tell you what kind of energy to have or what your kids should believe in school or a number of other things. And so I think there's an appetite out there, and what I believe is an instinctively conservative nation for some leadership. And I think the challenge for the Liberals is to find young leaders who can articulate these views. Somebody like, for instance, a Senator James Patterson, who I think is a great force for principled conservatism in Canberra. You got to find those guys, you have to promote them, and you have to get out there and counter some of these crazy talking points, like the idea that renewable energy is going to solve Australia's problems. Give me a break. You're sitting on heaps and heaps and heaps of coal. You should use it.
But so your critics will come back to you and say that Australia has signed up to the Paris Climate Change Treaty in late 2015. Now, I know President Trump has pulled the Americans out of that treaty. We in Australia have obligations to decarbonize
the economy.
That's what they would say
carbon,
in response.
Carbon is not a pollutant. It's essential to life. It shows you how immensely uninformed, and stupid this debate has become if you think carbon is a bad thing. Again, I go back to my original point. This is the most resource-rich country in the world, and it's only through government decisions and interference that the poorest Australians are paying 20-30% price hikes in their energy costs and suffering greatly as a result of it. And I think the blame for that lies right in Canberra.
Mary, it's always great to have you on the show.
Great to be with you, Tom.
That was Mary Kissel from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. She's in Australia as a guest of the IPA. And next week, for different views, we'll chat with Brendan O'Connor from the US Study Centre and Andrew Shearer, a former senior advisor to Prime Ministers Tony Abbott and John Howard.